Thy tongue deviseth mischiefs, like a sharp razor working deceitfully. Thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than speaking righteousness. Selah. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. He shall take thee away and pluck thee out of thy dwelling place and root thee out of the land of the living. Selah. The righteous also shall see it and fear and shall laugh at him. Lo, this is the man that made not God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. But I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise thee forever because thou hast done it, and I will wait on thy name, for it is good before thy saints. Thus ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. This morning we come in our monthly prayer meetings to Psalm 52. Psalm 52. It is an instructive psalm. It's one of those psalms that contrasts godly and the ungodly. We've seen eight so far. This is the ninth. We have an extensive title here in Psalm 52. We're informed that it's to the chief musician. So we're informed that it's to be maintained and to be used corporately by him. We're told that it is a maskil or an instructive. And usually when that word is used in the introductions to the Psalms in the first verse, it's usually instructive related to the influence of suffering. It's instruction through suffering. We see that in Psalm 32 and 42. We're also told this is one of the Davidic Psalms. We have about 75 Psalms that are clearly David's, and then probably some more that are what we call orphan Psalms that aren't titled David's Psalms, but clearly are. We have a couple references in the New Testament where we are told by the New Testament writers that the psalm that they are quoting is David's, even though the title of the psalm, it doesn't inform us that it's a Davidic psalm. We also learn the actual occasion here. Sometimes we have to guess at the occasions, but here there's no need to guess. We're told that it's when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul and said unto him, David is come to the house of Ahimelech. So this is referring to the occasion in 1 Samuel 21, 1 through 7, where David, running from Saul, fleeing from Saul, comes to Nob, to the priest of Nob, Ahimelech, and asks for food. He's given showbread, and we see there the extraordinary situation where David, as the anointed of God, is given something that ordinarily would not be for ordinary food, but in a desperate need, Ahimelech gives it to him. And in the New Testament, we find that that was, in fact, an honored practice. It was approved by God. But we also see that Doeg happens to be there. And he then, in chapter 22, 9 through 23, goes back to Saul and informs Saul that Ahimelech has been a party with David in his so-called rebellion, when in fact Ahimelech was unaware that Saul was chasing David at the time. David keeps that from him. He's unaware of that. And so Doeg really twists the truth or gives a partial truth as the whole truth, and thus he betrays Ahimelech and his family. It's very interesting when Saul's prepared then to kill Ahimelech and the 70 priests of Nob. Saul's servants, who would ordinarily be the ones that would slay the ones that were guilty of blood, and would not slay him, and so he had to ask Doeg to slay Ahimelech and the 70 other priests and their families. But we find there that Abiathar, one of the sons of Ahimelech, escapes and comes to David and tells him what happens. And so this clearly is then the response of David to God. I've entitled this psalm, O Thou Deceitful Tongue, from verse 4b. And here in this psalm we have David arraigning Doeg in verse 1, Then we have him accusing and convicting Doeg in verses 2 and 3. Then he sentences Doeg in 4 and 5. And then he triumphs in Doeg's execution in 6 and 7 before triumphing in his own stability, which I would contend is an example of the stability of the people of God. So briefly, we have David arraigning Doeg here in verse 1. We see Doeg in verse 1a, glorifying in his shame. Why boastest thou thyself in mischief, O mighty man? He's even boasting in what he has done. And then David speaks of the heinousness and the folly of his sin when he says, the goodness of God endureth continually. In other words, Doeg dishonored the goodness of God. God remains good. And yet Doeg, and God remains in charge, and yet Doeg has dishonored that in his behavior. He's not acted consistently with God. Doeg was an Edomite, and yet he was an Edomite who aligned himself with Saul and went through the motions of being a true professor of the true religion. He was, it says in 1 Samuel 21, detained before the Lord. He was there at Nob going through some external religious exercises. And yet, he obviously is not behaving consistent with God here. And then we find in verses 2 and 3, David accusing and convicting Doeg. Just as Doeg had done against Ahimelech in Saul's court, so we find David doing this in God's court by faith. He charges Doeg with three things: with malice in verse 2, or mischiefs, with falsehood or deceit in verse 2b. He says his words are like a razor, a sharp razor. I think the metaphor here is a picture of a sharp blade in which men would shave themselves or have someone else shave them. And they basically put themselves inches from having their neck sliced. And so here, it was the picture of being able to trust somebody with a sharp blade by your neck, and yet he was prepared to slice the neck of Ahimelech. Because David says, as he charges him with an affection or a love for sin, in verse 3, thou lovest evil more than good, and lying rather than speaking righteousness. Selah. Reminds us of Jesus' words in Matthew 12:34, out of the heart the mouth speaketh. And so clearly, this is a demonstration of Doeg's evil heart. He desired to harm others, and therefore he was prepared to lie to do so. And then we have a Selah here at the end of 3, a pause for us to think about what we've just learned about this wicked man. Spurgeon, commenting on this Selah, says, let us pause and look at the proud, blustering liar. Doeg is gone, but other dogs bark at the Lord's people. Saul's cattle master is buried, but the devil still has his drovers who fain would hurry the saints like sheep to the slaughter. So Doeg is gone, but there are many others in church history just like Doeg, and there are still many alive today just like him. And so then we have in verses 4 and 5, David sentencing Doeg. He tells us in verse 4 that destroyers will be destroyed. Thou lovest all devouring words, O thou deceitful tongue. So here he speaks of his devouring words or his furious, vicious oratory. Calvin thinks here that the root word in Hebrew that for this word devouring is hiding or concealing. And he seems to want to emphasize this, that these devouring words are concealing or hidden words. He's telling part of the truth, but not the whole truth. And for that reason, they are devouring, certainly to Ahimelech and the others there at Nob. And then David goes on to say that Doeg will be condemned in verse 5. God shall likewise destroy thee forever. So David, with the eye of faith, sees the sentence upon Doeg and his kind. He tells us that he will be driven out of the church. God will pluck thee out of thy dwelling place. And so we see that Doeg despised all the privileges that he had in God's house. He was interested in those privileges. Those privileges afforded him external privileges at the hand of Saul. And so he was willing to pretend as a child of God. And yet, in this, he demonstrates he really despised all those privileges. They were but superficial to him. But David also, by faith, says that he'll be driven out of the world and out of life and will root thee out of the land of the living. Spurgeon here says, those who will not let live have no right to live. Those who will not let live have no right to live. And so here, by faith, David imposes the death penalty, or sees God imposing the death penalty, eternal death penalty upon Doeg for his behavior. Then we have another Selah here at the end of verse 5, another pause to contemplate the sentence upon this wicked man. And then in verses 6 and 7, we have David triumphing in the execution of Doeg. He says, the righteous also shall see. Remember, God permitted Mordecai to see Haman hanging on the gallows. And so here he's informing us that the righteous will see the downfall of the wicked. They will, he says, see and fear. In other words, their seeing will bring or will have a sobering effect upon them. They will see and they will fear. They will glorify God in reverence to Him when they contemplate God's judgment upon the wicked. They'll do it to the glory of God in verse 6a. The righteous also shall see and fear, but they shall also do it to the shame of Doeg and those like him, and shall laugh at him. Lo, this is the man that made not God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. They shall laugh at him. I think we have to understand this as we understand God laughing from heaven in Psalm 2 as a solemn contempt. A solemn contempt for the man. Here the righteous say, lo, look at this man. So we're to take notice. We're to take observe God's providence in his judgment upon this man. We're to notice what was at the root, the issue with the man. Lo, here's the issue. It's no longer his lying. It is that this is the man that made not God his strength. He didn't build upon the rock. But secondly, on the flip side of the coin, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. His trust was upon what he had physically, not upon God. He made cisterns of his own making and he trusted in them rather than trusting in God himself. And so that is at the heart of his wickedness and why God will bring him down for his lack of submission and trust in God. And then here at the end in verses 8 through 9, we have David triumphing in his own stability. And I believe he is here an example of the Christian and the fact that we can triumph by faith in the stability that's ours through the grace of God. He says, but I am like a green olive tree in the house of God. I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever. I will praise thee forever because thou hast done it, and I will wait on thy name, for it is good before thy saints. Here to me, Psalm 52, verses 8 and 9 here approximates Psalm 1. We see the picture of the evil man in the first seven verses. Here we see of the beauty of the godly man. David here likens himself and the Christian to a green olive tree. Elderly saints are pictured as a green olive tree in Psalm 92:14 that still bear fruit in their old age. And in bearing fruit in their old age, demonstrate that God is a God of grace, that they're sustained by something beyond, someone beyond them in their own strength. But it's God's grace that causes them to bear fruit. But here he contrasts, and it's very interesting, in the Psalms we have this green olive tree referred to here and in Psalm 92, but in Psalm 37:35 we have the wicked spoken of as a green bay tree. And a bay tree is a tree that remains green but bears no useful fruit. And so they look like they have a profession, but there's no fruitfulness there. But God speaks, or David speaks of himself and Christians as green olive trees or flourishing olive trees. Olive trees that bear useful fruit. But he does so, if you notice, in God's greenhouse, in the house of God. The garden in which this fruitful tree is planted is the house of God, the church, the body of the Lord Jesus Christ. John Calvin, commenting here, says, "Here let us engrave the useful lesson upon our hearts, that we should consider it the great end of our existence to be found numbered amongst the worshipers of God, and that we should avail ourselves of the inestimable privileges of the stated assemblies of the church, which are necessary helps to our infirmities and means of mutual excitement and encouragement." He says, being in the assemblies of God, worshiping God, being in His special presence, Lord's Day by Lord's Day, helps our infirmities, but it's also a means to mutual excitement. He's not speaking of a charismatic, superficial excitement, but he's speaking of excitement to duty and encouragement or consolation in our afflictions and sufferings. And so David, speaking of himself and of the Christians here, speaks of the Christian in a threefold way. He says, speaks first of our life of faith and holy confidence. "I trust in the mercy of God forever and ever." So here God's eternal mercy is David's present confidence. He finds confidence in God's eternal mercies. Consider Hosea 12:6. "Turn thou to thy God. Keep mercy in judgment and wait on God continually." Wait on God continually. So the Christian has a life of faith and holy confidence. Secondly, he has a life of thankfulness and holy joy. Verse 9a, "I will praise thee forever because thou hast done it." Here David resolved to worship. And his rationale is God's great judgment upon the wicked. Remember the words of Hebrews 13:15. "By Him, therefore," by Christ, "therefore, let us offer the sacrifice of praise to God continually. That is the fruit of our lips giving thanks to His name." So he resolves to continue to offer a sacrifice of praise. And then he also resolves in 9b to live a life of expectation, of hope and humble dependence. "And I will wait on thy name, for it is good before thy saints." I will, David says. He resolves that he will presently wait upon God and will continue throughout his life to wait upon God. He says that he'll do it before thy saints. He returns again to the context in which the Christian lives his life in the body of Christ, amongst God's people and in God's presence. Before thy saints. In the house of God, And I believe here David could also be suggesting that he will set an example of these things before God's people. He'll be a testimony to the saints as he lives a life of faith and holy confidence, a life of thankfulness and joy, a life of expectation, hope, and humble dependence. Now consider Lamentations 3:26, where Jeremiah says, "It is good that a man should both hope and quietly wait for the salvation of the Lord." It's a good thing to wait and to hope upon God's salvation, upon His deliverance. Now, in application, consider the words of Matthew Henry. He says concerning this psalm, "In singing this psalm, we should conceive a detestation of the sin of lying, foresee the ruin of those who persist in it, and please ourselves with the assurance of the preservation of God's church and people in spite of all the malicious designs of the children of Satan, that father of lies." Let us close in prayer.